time for us to end this hierarchy of who has the right to live, who deserves not to suffer.
As an indigenous person, the fur trade represents so much more to me than just animal abuse. It represents cultural genocide.
That is fully summarized in a 6 or 8 in the raiding party.
It was racist, but we would not know about the terrible...
These kinds of actions are going to be more and more frequent.
Every laboratory rig can help from information from inside the lab, from someone who works there, who's sick of hearing the animals scream.
They found the animals crippled and helpless, unable to use their arms and legs. No food or medical care. Broken bones. Fingers and toes torn off.
14 of the 2 dozen protesters were blocking the entrance of the...
That's why the receptionists say the animals have been taken to an undisclosed location out of state.
We want the public to learn the truth, but our government is operating concentration camps.
Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. Rob Moore is taking a break this week, and we are joined also by Lamia, who is teching for us today.
Hello, hello.
We are going to have a very packed program. We're doing a follow-up program to our Hurricane Katrina program that we did in September. We wanted to make sure that the rescue efforts were going well, find out what was done, what still needs to be done to help animals that were affected by Hurricane Katrina. We're going to be joined by the President and CEO of United Animal Nations, as well as a representative from PETA, Laura Brown, who has been directly involved with rescuing animals in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina. So I'm really excited to talk with her. And we're also going to be speaking with Tricia Ritterbush from Farm Sanctuary, and she's going to tell us all about helping farmed animals in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina as well. So I hope you stick around for that. But before we jump into that very full program, I wanted to share with you some news that Rob Moore so kindly passed on to me today. So I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get through it all, but I will try my best. I should start off by saying that the story that we had on the program last week about the mouse who, I guess, was reported as starting a house on fire was actually came out as a hoax. If you go to wsbtv.com, you will see a story that says flaming mouse story found to be false. Rumor squashed, flaming mouse didn't start house fire. So that story that was came out of New Mexico actually was not true. What happened was the person that had their house burned down, he actually had killed the mouse prior to it being placed in the burning leaves, and the mouse did not go back into the house. So we wanted to make sure that we corrected that and let people know.
I wish that mouse had ran back to the house and burnt
yeah.
it down.
I mean, yeah, it's funny because the...
I mean, not that because I don't wish that people have burnt down houses, but it'd be nice if that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, the story at the end, if you look at the end of the news story, Mayers, who is the guy that had his house burnt down, he said, "I started laughing and I'm laughing from now on. It's silly." And that was in reference to this wild fabrication that happened and how it was picked up and...
That got
all
over
the
place.
Yeah, it was huge, and people really clung to the story. I think there's something about stories that could get positioned as revenge stories that are very compelling for people.
Mm.
But it's strange because now he's kind of laughing at it, and it brings a smile to his... it's a confusing... So I smell a dissertation or something happening. Just looking at that phenomenon of revenge animals. So if there's some...
I smell a dissertation.
Prospective grad student out there looking for something. Okay, so this is from Reuters, a story about Greenpeace. A Japanese whaling harpoon narrowly missed an inflatable boat carrying environmental protesters, causing one to fall into the freezing sea, as both sides warn their face-off is becoming increasingly dangerous. The Greenpeace vessel Arctic Sunrise has been shadowing the Japanese whaling fleet for several weeks in an attempt to disrupt Japan's annual whale hunt, promoting a heated exchange on January 8th when the Greenpeace ship and a Japanese ship collided. In the latest incident on Saturday, the harpoon came within a meter of the inflatable boat as it tried to shield a mink whale, the environmental group said. The harpoon's trailing line knocked one activist into the sea. He scrambled back aboard the boat without injury. Australia, a strong opponent of Japan's whaling program, has refused to intervene by sending Navy ships to monitor the whaling and protest. Foreign Minister Alexander Downer said last week Australia sympathized with the protesters, but said that they had to make sure that the protest was peaceful and did not endanger anyone. This is a story from foodnavigator-usa.com. Food safety fears have led to the emergence of a new market in vegetarian supplement ingredients, and industry insiders predicting that as many as half of all ingredients could be non-animal derived in the next 10 years. Scares such as BSE in cattle and avian flu in poultry have prompted consumers and marketers to cast about for supplements containing no animal derivatives, and that means ingredient companies are having to reconsider the carriers they use or develop synthetic variants or seek out vegetarian sources for many of their products. Lucas Christian, Global Product Manager for Beta-Carotene at DSM Nutritional Products, told NeutralIngredients.com that he believes that the demand for non-animal ingredients stems not so much from growing numbers of traditional vegetarians, but from people who are concerned about diseases in certain animal species. Christian says he does not expect that the animal-derived ingredients to disappear completely, but that vegetarian versions are likely to become more than a niche over the next 5 to 10 years, representing 30 to 50% of all ingredients. Chris Ollivant of the UK's Vegetarian Society told NeutralIngredients.com that numbers of vegetarians tend to peak in the immediate aftermath of an animal health scare, but drop down to prior levels afterwards. Overall, he said vegetarianism has followed a steady upwards curve over the past decade. A 2002 Data Monitor report estimated that there are around 12 million vegetarians in Europe. Another story from Reuters. European consumers who prefer meat and dairy products from humanely treated animals may soon be able to buy farm produce stamped with an EU quote-unquote welfare label. Noting a seismic shift in consumer opinion towards promoting animal welfare rather than merely preventing cruelty and avoidable suffering, the European Commission says it is keen to see more farm products obtained using high welfare standards. One way to achieve this, it says in a 5-year plan to improve treatment of animals, would be to create a label to help consumers choose between the minimum and higher welfare standards for the meat, milk, or eggs that they want to buy. Quote, the establishment of an EU label for animal welfare is an option to be explored in the near future, which could promote products elaborated under high welfare standards, unquote, it said. Quote, there has been a shift of public attitudes towards animals over the recent decades and how animals are considered in society, said the plan obtained by Reuters. Retailers and producers were increasingly recognizing animal welfare as a key element of product image and quality, it said. EU marketing standards for eggs and poultry meat already include some rules on animal welfare labeling. In 2005, the Commission called for tighter hygiene and welfare rules for the billions of chickens slaughtered in the EU each year for their meat, often packed in poor conditions. The Commission will publish its animal welfare plan next week and present it to EU agriculture ministers on January 23rd. It sets out a series of proposed monitoring reports and ideas for draft laws at various stages between 2006 and 2010. It calls for the EU to look at alternatives to animal testing, particularly for cosmetics industry, and how to control the trade in dog and cat fur and improvements in satellite navigation systems to monitor vehicles transporting animals long distance across the 25-nation region. It aims to respond to EU public opinion, since the majority of European citizens believe that the welfare of farm animals, particularly cattle, pigs, and poultry, to be very poor. Apart from general laws on animal and farm welfare, the EU only has specific legislation on veal, sows, and laying hens. The plan also suggests that new rules are needed for other species, like beef and dairy cattle, sheep, turkeys, and ducks. And two stories about Hurricane Katrina. This is from the Associated Press. Puppies are popping up everywhere amid the rubble left by Hurricane Katrina. Animal welfare workers are seeing the tip of what they fear will be a big boom in dog births in parts of Louisiana and Mississippi hammered by the storm. Officials say that more than 6,000 pets were saved in the region after Katrina came ashore August 29, and many of them were relocated to new homes elsewhere in the country. An unknown number drowned in the floodwaters or died later of injuries. But thousands of animals remain, and humane organizers are beginning to see the result of even small numbers of animals running loose for weeks in neighborhoods where fences were flattened and owners fled. Quote, I've never seen so many puppies in my life, said Manny Massell, an animal control officer from New Bedford, Massachusetts, who has made two trips to the south to help trap loose dogs and cats in New Orleans and Mississippi. New puppies are brought in daily by residents and workers such as Michelle, who is among 8 professional trappers working with the Humane Society of the United States to help capture animals running loose in the hurricane zone. They use harmless wire cages baited with food and lassos to capture dogs and cats. A big part of the job for Michelle and partner Janice Moore of Springfield, Vermont, is encouraging pet owners to help stem the puppy boom by having their animals spayed or neutered. Michelle and Moore drive through mostly abandoned neighborhoods checking reports of stray animals and asking people to let them, quote-unquote, fix their pets for free. Some animal owners, even those living out of vans, while their battered homes were being repaired, don't want to part with their pets for fear that they will never see them again. Quote, a lot of times it's the only thing I've got, Moore said. Animals without owners often wind up at the shelter, where workers are overwhelmed despite the trickle of volunteers still coming through to help walk dogs and clean up. As many as 75 new animals arrive daily at the shelter, including entire litters of puppies, and there is no immediate end in sight despite the work of trappers and the push to get animals spayed and neutered. A final story from Marietta Times. A woman who spent her Christmas vacation helping animals displaced by Hurricane Katrina has returned home with rewarding memories of her service. Quote, the trip was a lot of hard work, but it was very rewarding to help the animals that needed us, said Charlene McCoy of Marietta. I was worried that there would be emotional, that they would be emotional wrecks, and for the most part, they were content. McCoy has been involved with organizations for years and decided to volunteer with Best Friends, the nation's largest no-kill animal sanctuary, in Utah after Hurricane Katrina. The organization has been in the New Orleans area since Katrina hit the area August 29 and remains there, helping find pets and reuniting them with their owners. McCoy said she worked and lived at the shelter in Tylertown, Mississippi, approximately 100 miles north of New Orleans, from December 26 to January 1st, feeding dogs and cats as well as playing with them. Since the disaster, Best Friends has helped rescue more than 3,000 animals. On December 16th, Best Friends, the Humane Society of the United States, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and the United Animal Nations joined forces for a final large-scale rescue effort of the thousands of displaced pets still roaming the streets of cities through the Gulf Coast, according to the Best Friends website. These animals may never find their homes again, but it's okay because they are going to be at the sanctuaries that Best Friends has in Utah, McCoy said. McCoy said that she was surprised to see how well most of the pets adapted to life in the makeshift kennels. Quote, it was a relief to see that animals were all right, that they were safe and loved. And on that note, we are going to be joined right now with the president and CEO of the United Animal Nations, who is involved with and will tell us more about the Emergency Animal Rescue Services, also known as EARS. Jennifer Fearing is joining us today. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us about the EARS program and how it's associated with the United Animal Nations.
Sure. Well, United Animal Nations is the organization. We were founded in 1987, but one of our very first programs that was established was the Emergency Animal Rescue Service. And in some ways, because of the significant publicity that disasters get, you know, we have a classic case of where our program becomes somewhat better well-known than our organization. So we are the organization. UAN funds and operates and coordinates everything having to do with EARS, which now has responded to more than 60 disasters all across the country since 1987.
And when I was talking to you on the phone about this interview, you stressed that you wanted to talk about being proactive as well, because I think often when people think about organizations that help with animals in disasters, they think about sort of a cleanup effort and not so much about prevention.
Right. I mean, it's really important to me, especially as, you know, we harness the emotions that people are feeling related to Hurricane Katrina and not feel a sense of disillusionment or despair that that's how it has to be. Because while obviously some disasters by nature are going to cause some, you know, displacement and heartache for all species, there are lots of things that we could be doing to take the situations that occur during disasters. We can take a lot of precautions to avoid them. And those can be sort of on the micro level, sort of within your family, making sure that your animal's accounted for. I mean, most families I know don't even have a disaster plan for themselves, much less one that involves their animals. And I think hopefully Katrina woke a lot of people up, maybe thinking about what, you know, what they should have on hand in case they needed to survive without, you know, being able to go to the grocery store for a couple weeks, and, you know, when they, and plotting maybe their evacuation route, and setting a time for how they would decide they were going to execute on that. And we are just really hopeful that people will, utilizing our website and other sites that have information about what to include in your disaster planning for your pet, that people, you know, take those precautions. On a grander scale, but not so grand, is making sure that your community has some sort of plan that involves animals in the disaster, and that the folks who are in charge of executing on that plan are actually involved in drills that take place, you know, training operations that take place, so that, you know, there's not just some piece of paper somewhere that says, this is what we're going to do with animals during disaster, but that it's actually been practiced. And, you know, making sure, if you can, talking to your local Red Cross chapter, who, you know, many of the times the determination about whether animals are allowed in Red Cross shelters is made at the local chapter level, not at the national level. So doing what you can in your community to, you know, engage people on this issue and making sure that the community is prepared to handle the problem appropriately.
Do you think that some people just figure that it won't happen to them, that, you know, if they had to get out, they would be able to get out and they'd be able to take their animals with them? What do you think prevents people from doing this type of pre-planning?
I think even after 9/11, people, I think, I don't know if I can attribute it, at least in America, to sort of a sense of, you know, overwhelming sense of security or safety or living in some sort of bubble. I mean, I don't know, and I certainly wouldn't want to pop it per se, but I do think that sense of, you know, because we're so protected and live in such a relatively calm society, that we don't think that those kind of things are going to happen to us, like you said. I mean, I can honestly share with you that I've been running UAN and been involved with disaster preparedness for almost 3 years now. I didn't make a disaster kit until after I went down to Louisiana and saw what happened. Mm-hmm. And it finally hit me that, what if I needed water? Like, it was so hard to come by water down there, and that's such a basic thing. Mm-hmm. And I actually came home from there, and it rattled me so much that I finally went out, and, like, my garage is stocked. And, you know, I think people even think I'm kind of wacky for doing that. But not anyone who spent any time in the Gulf Coast, and not anyone who was from there. So I just hope, you know, we tend to have a short memory about these things, and I just hope that people take it seriously. I mean, I live, for example, here in Sacramento. Since the discussions about the, you know, the levees in New Orleans, there's been a big discussion going on here. We live in the most flood-prone area in the country. So we're really hoping to, just in our own hometown, really increase awareness about these issues and make sure people are prepared. But, you know, I don't know, short of scaring people, it's hard to think how to get people to, you know, get prepared for these things. But like I said, a secondary level would be making sure your community is making plans so that how evacuations are handled and where pets are accommodated and how that process works, and making sure they know what resources are available from nonprofit organizations like UAN and others, will help in the event that people don't take those precautions individually and are going to then be relying on community services.
Okay, so there's two things that I wanted to follow up with what you were saying. One is that you mentioned you have a kit, that you put together a kit, and I guess water would be part of that. But can you give us a quick sense of what else would be in a kit like that? I know that you want people to do more research and to find out maybe more of the specifics for each animal, and to do some research through websites like the United Animal Nations. But just as a general sketch, what would be some of the things in a kit for a disaster?
Well, I can tell you that when I made my kit, I had to take care of not only my animals but myself. And as a vegan, that required me to think a little bit, especially about how I was going to, you know, make sure that my dietary needs were met in that situation. But between all of us, I have in my research, I've learned that you want to basically have a gallon of water per person per day on hand, and you don't have to do a lot of math to figure out how much water that is. And I'm allocating the same amount to my dog and half that amount to my cat. You want to have, you know, if they're on any chronic medications, you want to have gotten, you know, an extra prescription filled, so you just have one always on hand in an emergency. And, I mean, that's a good idea, disaster or no disaster, just to have that, but especially having that in your kit. Any special dietary needs that they have, you're not going to be able to just, like, throw Ritz crackers at them. So you need to don't let your dog food or your cat food run all the way down to the bottom. You want to make sure that you have, you know, a stash that's good for 2 to 3 weeks. You want to have extra leashes and cages and crates, even if your animals don't typically spend time confined that way. If you are going to go to an animal shelter or a human shelter, the more that you can be self-sufficient during a disaster, the better, and the less taxing you are on your community. And for me, just because I'm someone who is kind of concerned about animals generally, I'm making sure that I am keeping a staff, or, you know, that would be enough to take care of maybe my neighbor's animal and other people who are close to me who may not deal with that, who I wouldn't want to confront my emotions in that situation in terms of trying to help other animals. And so I'm keeping cans of cat food, the kinds of things that most of us who maybe do animal rescue have on hand to kind of lure the occasional stray into our possession. I'm keeping extra towels and flip leaves and canned cat food, for example, so that I may be able to help in that circumstance. In the event of a disaster, as I heard your piece before, the best ones people are finding, everybody, including the animals, get more desperate. And I don't want to be in a situation where I can't help them.
So the second thing that you wanted to, that I wanted to follow up with is a comment that you made about why you ended up putting this kit together. You said that you were rattled when you went down to Louisiana. So what have you seen there, and what has the United Animal Nation, specifically EARS, been involved with in terms of helping out?
Well, I think just seeing, I mean, that's sort of one thing to watch the images of the devastation on television, and I think, because we see so many movies, that it's hard to really get your arms around the reality of that. And it took going down there for me and seeing kind of firsthand, houses blown down and cars tossed and all the utilities down and not working and just, really kind of a crazy war scene almost, to see that in person and to be worried about the kinds of things that happened in that circumstance. It was just so new for me and I guess at some level kind of frightening, but it just got my attention in a way that sort of even being engaged in this in the past has not. EARS, our Emergency Animal Rescue Service, is almost exclusively operated by volunteers. We have one paid staff and the other 2,399 people who assist with our disaster relief programs are all volunteers. So they're training one-day workshops that we hold around the country that we'll be holding again this year. But about 400, somewhere between 400 and 500 of those folks went down and helped operate. I think all told, between Katrina and Rita, we were either fully operating or assisting with the operation of five shelters across the three states of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. We, handled and cared for approximately 2,000 animals during that time, many of whom were able to be reunited with their families, but the majority of whom were sent on to, appropriate animal welfare agencies around the country who were able to help them. But I can tell you, kind of the good story and the bad story. I mean, we just had an amazing story last week about one of our volunteers who had helped at one of our Louisiana shelters and fallen in love with a dog and kind of paid attention to where he ended up out in North Carolina. And she was making plans to fly him out and take him on as her own dog. When the owner came forward the night before from New Orleans, she'd lost three of her other dogs, and she finally tracked down this old, 9-year-old black lab, male black lab, most common dog in animal shelters across the country. She found him. The two of them, plus the woman in North Carolina who was caring for them, created this huge bond, and last week they all flew to Wilmington to celebrate Sir Romeo's 9th birthday together. And it's just an amazing story. And those women are jointly figuring out a plan for how they're going to care for Sir Romeo together until the owner is back up on her feet and can take care of him. On the dark side of what can happen from disasters, as you may or may not be aware, there were several hundred dogs that were transferred by some rescue groups to a quote-unquote sanctuary in the Ozarks in Arkansas, which turned out to be an awful, awful cruelty case. And the Humane Society of the United States and our EARS program for a month took over that facility while an investigation was ongoing and gave those animals just a ton of care and removed 20 tons of debris off the property. It was just a hideous sight. And we just got word that yesterday the owners of that facility were, they faced 28 misdemeanor animal cruelty counts, and they were, they got booked on 20 of them. She was arrested for some felony animal cruelty issues and theft in Missouri. So we're really happy that the outcome there, she was told they will never own dogs again. Mm. So, there's sort of the good side of what comes out and the bad side, and even that bad situation was able to be turned good, but there's just a lot that goes on after disaster that makes, the disaster go on for months.
Were you happy with how yours functioned? Were the plans to help animals executed well? Do you feel like the organization was able to come together and face the barriers head on that they were dealing with in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina?
Well, we're really proud of our Emergency Animal Rescue Service folks and our volunteers, many of whom actually did multiple tours of duty down there, coming back, you know, after a week's stay and staying for another 2 weeks at another time, and we're extremely proud of them. But like all good organizations, we have stopped and taken notes after this, and we had a big debrief, and we thought of all kinds of ways, you know, that this massive disaster, which will expose any organization's weaknesses, I'm sure, and their strengths, but we decided we, you know, want to really make sure that next time we would be able to do it even better. And one way we're doing that is trying to secure even more formalized collaborations with some of the other agencies and nonprofits that provide these services, so that we're all working as kind of one smooth machine to the extent possible. And I think we'd be able to help the animals a lot more if we did that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge coordinating effort in the midst of crisis. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming to think about how one would begin to do that, but I was quite impressed to see that the United Animal Nations was able to work with different organizations to coordinate some of the efforts together. It was quite amazing.
Well, for the first time ever, there was a daily conference call that we coordinated that was held every single day for 36 days in a row, weekends included, through September, where every single organization, government agencies, anyone involved at a leadership level was invited to get on this call, and it was an amazing communications opportunity and an opportunity to clear up confusion. You know, a lot of us are trying to help run logistics and assist with this from afar because that's where we are, and so trying to really get a handle of what the situation is on the ground in various places. It was extremely useful, and it was a model that I think everyone involved wants to repeat again in the future. But just like I said, you know, in communities where there has to be more than a plan. There has to be, you know, like practice and action and communication before a disaster. It's really, really hard to make friendships and develop trust in the middle of a disaster because everybody's really stressed out. And there's a lot on the line and a lot of pressure to save, in our case, as many animals as we can. And your organization, ours is a very small organization, especially relative to like CAPIS US and the ASPCA. We're tiny. And the expectations that come over us during a disaster just become huge. So it's much more advantageous for the animals and for the people who support our organization, you know, that we are having these conversations and creating these relationships outside disaster. So, you know, you're not just like meeting people for the first time in the middle of a crisis. And I think that's one of the things that we won't have to worry about going forward because a lot of those relationships were formed. And there are lots of discussions underway about how to take them forward.
Some good, solid networking happening.
Absolutely.
So with an
eye on, you know, what really matters, which is helping these animals and their families.
Right. So what is the vision, then, of what is going on the ground right now? We've come about over 4 months since the initial landfall of Hurricane Katrina. What is still left to be done there?
Well, we are, as I heard you mention, helping with the best friends effort, although our assistance, I should be totally clear, is primarily financial. And we're encouraging, you know, our trained air volunteers to volunteer with the best friends effort. But we don't actually have, you know, we're not coordinating a specific rescue effort down there now. We got tied up, as I mentioned, in this responding to this cruelty case in Arkansas, which went on for 5 or 6 weeks on the tail end of our Katrina relief effort. And just given our size, that was sort of all we could take on. But we've been financially supporting what I understand to be a continuing trapping program and feeding-in-place program as they kind of try to manage pulling the number of animals that are still running around out in a flow that they can actually manage. And those animals are being spayed and neutered and evaluated and moved on to other shelters or, in some cases, to the best friend's sanctuary. But another exciting thing that's happening that we're working with ASPCA and HSUS on is the development of some massive sort of long-term, large-scale spay neuter programs for the states of Mississippi and Louisiana. And I'm actually going down there in a couple weeks to help consult on the development of a big voucher program, and there are going to be a couple clinics that are going to spring up, because if we learned one thing about what really was a disaster sort of every day, long before Katrina hit, is the rampant pet overpopulation problem down there, which exceeds even what most of us are unfortunately used to in our own communities. We have never seen in any of our disaster relief efforts so many unaltered animals show up in our shelters. So I'm really excited that there's a long-term investment being made on the part of the organizations that responded to trying to mitigate, like I said to you earlier, the importance of proactivity. If we can vastly reduce the number of animals that are there, that's not only a good thing for any future disasters, but that's just a good thing all the time. And that's just an area that probably needed that attention and warranted that attention before this disaster, but it took Katrina to really, like, focus the spotlight on it.
It sounds like Hurricane Katrina woke up a lot of people or shook a lot of people pretty intensely. We're going to end our interview there. I wanted to thank you so much, Jennifer, for being on the program today and for all of your fabulous work with the United Animal Nations. We really appreciate talking to you today.
Sure, thank you. And I just want to encourage your listeners to visit our website at uan.org, either to check out kind of the disaster planning tips we have or to look into what it means to become an EARS volunteer so that you can either respond to an upcoming disaster or just be more educated to help your family or your community.
Keep us posted about what you're up to. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with the CEO and president of the United States group, United Animal Nations. We're going to do a little ad, and then we're going to maybe listen to a little bit of music, and then we're going to come back with Laura Brown. I'm really excited to talk to her. She is involved with the Domestic Animal and Wildlife Department in with PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. She's done a lot of on-the-ground work with helping animals affected by Hurricane Katrina, and we're going to hear some of her rescue stories and some of the barriers she faced during her time doing that work. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
Hi, listeners. Doesn't Lauren sound nice when she's nice and loud like that?
We had a bit of a technical... We've had some technical issues.
It's technical issue day.
The beautiful realities of live radio. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to let people know that you are listening to Animal Voices. If you have any questions or comments for us, if you have ideas or feedback, send them to animalvoices@ciut.fm. And also our website is www.animalvoices.ca, and there's over 100 archive programs, as well as last week's show where we talked to a new vegan as well as the woman who does the website Vegan Lunchbox. So check it out. Jennifer McCann, who runs that site, recently got the PETA Blog of the Year Award, and she was really excited about it. It's a very cool site. We are not going to be speaking right now with Laura Brown yet. We weren't able to reach her. Hopefully we'll hear from her in a few minutes. But instead we're going to switch earlier now to an interview with a person from Farm Sanctuary. I'm really excited that we get to speak with Tricia Ritterbrook Bush from Farm Sanctuary, and she's going to tell us about some of the efforts that Farm Sanctuary has been involved with, and she's the Director of Communications with them. Thank you very much for being on the line today, Tricia.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we are on a limited time schedule here, so tell us quickly about what Farm Sanctuary has done to help animals affected by Hurricane Katrina.
Well, as soon as we heard that the hurricane was hitting, we actually started gathering our emergency rescue team. We have a group of folks that help us out anytime there is a major natural disaster. We've been involved in tornadoes in the past that have hit egg-laying factories. And so we mobilized, went down there, and we also were in constant contact with HSUS, as well as another animal sanctuary on the West Coast, Animal Place. And we had representatives from all the different groups down there, and we met up and we just started going from farm to farm because we knew that that particular region where the eye of the storm went through in Mississippi, the five surrounding counties actually are some of the largest broiler-producing counties in the U.S. So there were literally millions of chickens down there being raised on factory farms.
It's always hard, I think, with radio to really give people a sense of exactly what things were like. But can you paint a picture for us about what type of scenes rescuers were encountering when they did go to these areas?
Well, they were going from farm to farm, and one of the the problems that they were running into initially. It took a few days before we were able to get entry into a farm to actually rescue animals. A lot of these are contract facilities that are contracted with some of the largest chicken-producing companies. The major one down there is Tyson. And basically, Tyson, the company, has legal ownership of the chickens, but no one from the company is actually represented at these farms. These are small farmers, well, not necessarily small farmers. They're large farmers that are just families that are raising these chickens, but they have no legal claim to them. So we were going from farm to farm, and oftentimes they were not letting us on the property, even though they were in such a desperate situation, and there were not representatives from Tyson there to handle any of this. We came across one farm that had five buildings. Each building held over 100,000 chickens. Two of them were completely destroyed, and there were literally thousands of chickens dead and alive everywhere. But basically, he was so frustrated, the farmer was, that he actually said, you know what, take whatever chickens you can, because I cannot deal with this. I'm going to have to just bulldoze them, alive and dead, into mass graves. So we were able to rescue over 700 chickens that we could load onto our transport trailers and bring them safely to shelter. But at the time, and we literally pulled 30 live chickens out of a mass grave that was 12 feet deep and just packed with dead and live animals in this open grave. So it was definitely a very traumatic experience for everyone that was on the ground at the time. And you want to be able to take all of the birds with you. But unfortunately, I mean, you only have so many transport trucks with you and so many people that at the time that could take these birds.
Yeah, I mean, rescue stories are always so bittersweet that way.
Right.
That there's always such a positive feeling, but of course, yeah. I mean, I was saying to you on the phone early this morning that I think that these numbers are just so huge that people have a hard time kind of conceptualizing, you know, that there's, if you were able to rescue around 750 birds, that really is only a fraction of the number of animals that were affected, that were in these facilities.
There were literally millions of farm animals that died as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And unfortunately, there aren't single numbers that are given. The USDA only tallies farm animals in relation to economic units. So they called it a $30 million loss. But we know that given how many factory farms are down there and given the large populations of chickens, there were also lots of pigs down there as well, and cattle that were stranded, literally just standing on whatever open land they possibly could and were surrounded by water. And to see after the fact that, I mean, of all the animals that were affected from Hurricane Katrina, farm animals really bore the brunt of the damage. And it went largely unnoticed on the massive kind of media scale because so much focus was put, and rightly so. I mean, there were lots of people that were affected by this, and lots of companion animals that were affected by this as well. But to actually think about the millions of animals that were confined in factory farms, they had no chance, many of them, for survival, because they, when a storm hit, and it's a massive storm on this scale, all of these feeding operations are automated. Everything is done by electric, and it's all automated. When those go down, these animals are literally confined in cages, and they starve to death. And that's what was happening over the course of September of this year.
You said that it was mostly broiler chickens then that were rescued.
Right.
What is the life of a broiler chicken like, and what are some of the confounding variables? We had talked about this briefly on the phone, too, that you said, you know, that it's sort of complicated by how chickens are raised nowadays.
Yeah, they've been selectively bred so much over the years to have certain qualities, and broiler chickens today, they look very different than other chickens or egg-laying chickens. Just as egg-laying hens are bred to produce an inordinate amount of eggs in a year, Now they're producing up to 300 eggs in a year, which is completely unnatural when a egg-laying chicken would normally produce just about 70. And broiler chickens are bred to put on a lot of weight very quickly. They actually are at slaughter weight at 45 days old. So we're literally, I mean, they're slaughtering chicks, but these chicks are so overgrown and far larger. And unfortunately, their skeletons, their bones have not grown to handle the amount of weight that's put on them. They have massive chests because of the preference for white meat that people have. So we see these birds now that are going on 5 months of age, and they're also bred to want to eat constantly. And they will. They will eat constantly. If you put feed out for them, they will just continue to eat, which is very unnatural. And we've noticed lots of crop problems where they'll actually eat their bedding. If you don't give them the food, they'll actually eat the straw around them and whatever bedding is around them. And then all of that gets caught up in their crop. And then they have all kinds of problems. And they literally, it gets so clogged in their crop that it can't go into their digestive tract. And they are actually starving. They can starve to death if you aren't managing the crop issue as you're working with them. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we've noticed, unfortunately, in a lot of the male birds in particular, they call it flip-over disease. It's a commonly known term in the rearing of chickens for meat. Because they're bred to put on so much weight so quickly, they'll actually, on occasion, and this happens in larger populations of the male birds because they even grow larger than the female birds, where they'll have a heart attack. And they will literally flip over and die immediately. And it's a massive heart attack that the birds have. And we've actually lost several of the male birds to this flip-over disease as we've had them. And many of them, these birds came in when they were about 3 weeks old. So they were baby chicks, and they weren't at slaughter weight, which was why they were actually bulldozing these chicks into mass graves. They weren't taking them to the slaughterhouse, and they didn't have any provisions for them or any way to manage this number of birds in this disaster. So their solution was to just bury them. So we've continually had issues with the flip-over disease, with crop problems, and then also they had gone without food for up to 10 days. So many of them, their bones had gotten really soft, and they actually had rickets. Hmm. So we've had to work with them as well, and they've had lots of problems with really soft, their bones just being very soft. But that actually is a common disease that birds get anyway in a factory farming setting. But because they're slaughtered at 45 days, it's something that they don't really manage beyond that. But we're seeing all kinds of health issues now as a result, not only from the trauma that they experience, but also from just the way that they're raised now in factory farms.
Hmm. I'm imagining for someone who's tuning into this program who isn't necessarily converted to vegetarianism or interested in animal rights, there, maybe they're thinking something like, well, you know, for rescuing companion animals, that's one thing, but, you know, these animals are just too stupid. They're eating all the time. They're, you know, they were going to die anyway. How do you respond to people who don't think that this work is worthwhile, or how do you articulate why you feel rescuing these animals is an important cause?
Every single bird and every animal that we have at Farm Sanctuary has a name, and each one of them has an individual personality, and they all feel pain. Just as your cat and dog feels pain or has the capacity to feel pain, so do these animals. And we've had a lot of individual animals, too, that, I mean, everyone gravitates. I mean, I'm within 200 yards of 1,200 animals, and there are certain ones that I've really connected with, and I love to go visit. There is one chicken. She was actually rescued from Hurricane Katrina. There was a group we called the Berry Bunch, because they actually found some berry bushes that they were able to feed off of, and they were actually the healthiest ones that came out of that. But their feathers got stained, so when we were rescuing them, we kind of set them aside because we pulled them out from underneath these berry bushes, and their feathers were stained pink. And one chicken in particular we called Paris
Right. She was quite the very showy and very healthy compared to the other chicks around, and they each do have such individual personalities. I mean, if you have, and oftentimes people just don't, they're so far removed from animals that are raised for food traditionally, and there's a reason why. I mean, people, our society actually does separate these animals from other animals. But the reality is these animals are just as sweet and just as curious as your cat or dog would be.
Sorry to interrupt you, we only have about a minute more left, or less than that. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to confirm where the animals are at now.
Most of the birds are still here at Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen. We have adopted out about 200 of the birds to other sanctuaries all along the eastern seaboard, and also through our farm animal adoption network. We have over 600 families throughout the U.S. They are vegetarian families, and they will adopt animals through our network, and they give them a safe home where they can live out the rest of their lives. So we've also adopted out other birds to those families as well.
Can you give us Farm Sanctuary's website, please?
Sure. It's farmsanctuary.org, and you can read all about the chickens. We have a running update on how the chickens from Hurricane Katrina are faring, as well as all of our other rescues that we have.
Thank you for speaking so elegantly on this and telling us about what has been happening for farm animals in those areas. It's such a sad situation, and it's very heartening to know that organizations like Farm Sanctuary exist. So thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Really
for
appreciate
me.
It. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm going to do my utmost to get Laura Brown from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals to talk about her firsthand account of helping animals and rescuing animals in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina. We're going to try to get her on next week. Thank you, Lamia, for dealing with all the technical problems.
My pleasure.
And stay tuned for Roan Renner. You're listening to CIUT 89.5.